My name is Susan Reed, and I'm supervising attorney at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. We're a statewide program serving immigrants with offices in Kalamazoo and Ann Arbor.
And I'm Megan Reynolds. I'm managing attorney of the Battle Creek Office of Legal Services of South Central Michigan. We're a general civil legal aid office that represents low-income persons and domestic violence survivors.
Okay. So when we talk about the issue of domestic violence, what do you two see on a fairly regular basis in your office and that maybe illustrates what kind of problem is out there?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center has a panel of over 100 pro bono volunteer attorneys handling immigration cases for immigrants who've been survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. And we see immigrant women from all walks of life all over the state. And so that's everyone from the farm worker who's trapped in an abusive situation because she's so economically dependent on her family unit, because, you know, the dynamics of domestic violence are just inescapable for her because of economics, because of fear of immigration enforcement if she were to contact police, all those issues, to folks who are women who are maybe mail order brides or in internationally brokered marriages, I guess is the official term, but who've really been brought by Michigan residents from abroad for sexual servitude. Not to suggest that all of those relationships are that way, but we see many of those relationships become a form of sexual servitude and often with very violent components. And so we serve those clients in helping them pursue immigration law remedies to get safe, secure immigration status. And we often work hand in hand with programs like the YWCA here in Kalamazoo or other programs that provide supportive services to our clients.
Mm-hmm.
My office represents domestic violence survivors who are ready to leave their relationship and need to services to become divorced from their abusive spouse, or where they were not married, there's often custody battles. And we accept cases that have been referred to us by domestic violence shelters in the counties we serve, those being Barry County, Calhoun County, and Branch County. And so I see people as they're leaving these relationships and having to start from scratch in terms of getting housing, reestablishing income, and fighting to have custody of their children.
Susan, to go back to you for a moment. How difficult does your situation get when we're talking about people whose legal status may be uncertain, their status here in the country? How much does that play into what you can do for them?
You know, there is actually a lot that we can do for domestic violence survivors. The Violence Against Women Act first passed in 1994, and now actually, though it has expired, the immigration and really needs to be renewed, the immigration provisions are still in effect. It provides a lot of remedies, along with a couple of other programs that provide a lot of remedies in the immigration law for victims of violence, not only women, but most commonly women, for victims of violence, sexual assault, violent crime in their relationships. And so there actually is a lot we can do once that survivor takes the step of reaching out. But what we find again and again is that the level of fear is so incredibly high, is that women have been told again and again by their abusers, you know, I will ensure that you never see your children again. I can make one phone call and have you deported. And just imagine the situation, right, of a mail order bride, right? Why wouldn't she believe that that's the case? She may come from a country with a repressive government. She may have she knows that the system is predicated on the family member who is a U.S. citizen petitioning for the non-citizen, right? That's what she's familiar with. That may be the process she started. And so why would she believe that she had rights when someone is telling her she has none? And, you know, the thing that I think is most common and most horrifying in these cases is so many women have told me, you know, when he tells me he's going to kill me, that's not the worst thing I've ever heard. It's when he tells me I'll live the rest of my life and I'll never see my children again. And so, again, there's so much we can do once we've identified survivors, but it's that identification that is the obstacle.
And for both of you, I guess the question becomes how much of this flies below the radar so that it doesn't make statistics, it doesn't factor into all of the things that we hear, but because, you know, reporting and those sort of things get a little hazy sometimes in terms of, you know, numbers and that sort of thing.
Well, immigrant and non-immigrant women alike are unlikely to report domestic violence. Often it's third parties who observe or can hear domestic violence playing out who are the ones to make the call. And statistically, I've read that it takes about 7 attempts for a woman to leave a domestic violence relationship if she is able to leave. And the most risky time for her physical safety is at the point that she does attempt to leave. So it's definitely underreported, but I think over years of, you know, studying this research and bringing out the voices of survivors, there's more and more awareness of the fact that the official reports underreport the incidents of it. And I think events like the one that's planned for Valentine's Day are an opportunity for women who've lived through it to not necessarily officially report it, but to rise up and discuss their experience with it.
And does that, has there been some evidence that is translated into women, as you say, there is somewhat more awareness. Does that translate in some way into women being able to extricate themselves better from a situation? As you noted, the most dangerous point is at which you do try to leave, but does the awareness make it more likely that someone might get help in that situation and may be able to escape a very dangerous situation?
I believe so. I mean, I believe that services like the YWCA and in Calhoun County, Safe Place is the name of the shelter. The services they provide are practical in terms of providing shelter, but they're also based on empowerment and feeling that one is not alone in this experience. And, you know, the other thing I think is so powerful for people who are making a break from violent situations is that often it is gender norms that are both the catalyst for violence and something that keeps people in the situations that, you know, violence is precipitated when the abuser feels that the woman has not performed her role as a woman adequately, either in not having sex often enough, not cleaning or cooking the way he believes women should. And also, you know, the men are burdened with a certain, you know, notion of masculinity that when they don't feel that they've achieved it, that precipitates violence. And so I think overall this conversation and making it public about, you know, people not policing the boundaries of gender norms and women feeling empowered to speak out publicly and share their experiences and women supporting each other in, you know, and men and women alike coming together in an event like this, I think, you know, it actually does then reach back into the experience of people who are struggling with, you know, am I a good person despite what I'm going through? Am I a good woman despite what I'm going through? And then it may create some strength and confidence that people lack and may, you know, be part of the solution.
And I suppose there's a couple different levels of discussion there. One is when the problem is going on, finding someone and saying, you know, hey, I've got a problem at home. I've been getting beat up or I feel threatened. And then there's the whole thing of after it happens. You know, do you find that women have a tough time discussing that and maybe working past some of the psychological scars that are left after an abusive relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. When we talk about the way that culture becomes part of it and the way that this 1 billion rising event affects culture and affects perceptions. I mean, I certainly see those cultural issues, those gender norm issues at play within families, within different national origin, you know, expressions of that culture. But I also see it come into play. We had a volunteer attorney on our panel tell me that she had been a survivor of domestic violence, and that was the reason she was volunteering for her panel, but that she'd never admitted it to anyone because she was a lawyer. She was a person who wanted to be perceived as powerful and strong, and that admitting that carried too much shame and too much stigma. So I think that's an example of how that's at play.
Agree, Megan?
I do. I mean, I think there's no doubt but that these life experiences leave scars on those of us who have been through it. And when you realize how common it is. I mean, this 1 billion figure is coming from an estimate that 1 in 3 women, girls and women, will be raped or otherwise violated during their lifetime. It's a huge part of, you know, life experience then for at least we're talking about girls and women in this conversation, but men too. I mean, many of the perpetrators of violence have themselves lived through violence. So an anti-violence conversation can lead to positive things in all directions.
Just to follow up on that, that idea that, you know, many of the abusers do experience something themselves. I mean, much in the same way that, for instance, you know, a pedophile has often been violated in their formative years. Is it a cycle, more or less, a cycle of violence that just continues through generations? Is that what happens?
Well, we talk about it as a cycle of power and control, and that's again where those gender norms we were talking about come in. Is that that's how you exercise control over someone, is you hold them within these norms and expectations, and then you police their behavior and use violence against them when you feel like, you know, you're entitled to because they've failed. And so there's this conversation of, you know, power and control that's looping, and then the children are pulled into it, the children are educated into it. I think there's a version of it in all families, but it's a particularly destructive conversation in families where power and control is enforced through violence.
Is it getting better in some ways? I mean, do you see this on a regular basis in a way that you feel that there is improvement? That obviously it still goes on, but is there any reason to think that everything that's been done is moving the needle in some way, that it's making it easier to come forward, making it easier to get help when it's needed?
I think that's a difficult question to answer because of some of the issues that we discussed earlier. And as a service provider, you know, the more people who come forward, in a certain sense, those are the more people who have either reached a point where they are ready to make a change for their children, where they're ready to confront fear, where they're ready to take risks. And in a certain sense, right, that's a positive thing. That's the kind of culture change that events like the 1 Billion Rising event contribute to. You know, I think that that attitudes change slowly over time. But I do think, in a certain sense, there's momentum, and events like the 1 Billion Rising event help contribute to that momentum of, you know, both in the United States and around the world, to that vision that the violence against women and girls is not acceptable, and that it's not a cultural value.
Megan, do you agree?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think making a strong statement that violence against women and girls is prevalent, needs to change, and that women and girls are being asked to rise up on this day to make that message for themselves is powerful and part of a direction for change. But as a service provider, again, we're often asked questions about decreasing the incidence of this. And there's one service provider I work with in Battle Creek, and I like that she always says, you know, the Red Cross is not asked whether or not they're decreasing natural disasters. And so as domestic violence service providers, we don't necessarily need to report that we are certain that what we offer is decreasing the incidence of domestic violence. We just need to know that it's effective in reaching those who need the help when they reach out for it.
If someone were to contact you and say, hey, I think I know someone who's in a abusive relationship, you know, I saw something, I heard something, etc. What are the things you would advise them? What you know, someone witnesses this, third party, what do they do about it?
I would want to make sure that person has access to both the local service provider information through the YWCA and the National Domestic Violence Crisis Hotline so that they could share that with that third party at any time. I would want to make sure that, again, this is a friend approaching me about a third party. I would maybe want to ask some questions about, you know, do you feel that that person you're concerned about has access to a telephone or has time alone where they could reach out for help? Are they ever allowed to be alone? And if not, are there opportunities that you could create? You know, I certainly wouldn't encourage someone to become directly involved, right, in the dynamics of a violent relationship. That could be very dangerous and could really create danger for the victim. But create an open space for listening. Look for opportunities to share information about resources would be my best advice. I do have to share one anecdote because I think often, you know, if something seems strange or seems off, it's worth listening to those instincts. You know, I had a client who was from Mexico, but was fluent in both English and Spanish, but her husband only spoke English. And so he did not want her to have the opportunity to speak with anyone who spoke Spanish because he wouldn't understand what she said, including her own mother. He would require a three-way call with her sister, who was bilingual, to translate for her so that she only spoke English to her own mother so that he could understand it. Now, what do you think the mother and the sister thought was going on in that situation, right? The mother and the sister were tipped off pretty quickly that that was completely bizarre. So not every situation is obvious, but very often in that quest for power and control, abusers will do things that are quite obvious and quite concerning. And I think creating the space for someone to share or the information someone might need to privately reach out is important. For folks who have internet access, there are a lot of web-based resources that are really cleverly done. You know, most of the domestic violence service providers and national organizations, they will offer an option that automatically erases your visit to the site from the web browser. You know, some of those opportunities, just as simple as thinking about someone's phone access and maybe, you know, subtly helping them with phone access, whether it's a prepaid phone. Just think of ways to make that person able to have independent communication with the world or with someone who might be able to help.
Is that something we miss sometimes in that whole idea of maybe asking why didn't someone just get help? Is that this is a very controlled, you know, usually people who are very manipulative and controlling and using power that they do set up these barriers and they do make it as difficult as they possibly can. You know, the translation on the phone is an example. Checking the web history on a computer. I mean, someone who is in
absolutely
that sort of control, they are going to make it very difficult for someone if they can't they?
That is 100% the experience of domestic violence, is that, you know, power and control is the heart and soul of the matter, and there's no better way to prevent someone from leaving than to put a lot of energy into making sure that they are not speaking outside of the relationship. They're not even given access to intimate people they've had intimate relationships with in the past, you know, their family, their friends, you know, people being shuttled to and from their job, making sure that they don't have a moment to themselves, you know, using technology to monitor their comings and goings and making it absolutely clear that they, whatever they think they're going to do to communicate their problem to the outside world, that the perpetrator will catch them and will punish them severely for that lapse. That is one of the central tools of the abuser.
Anything else either of you care to add?
No, I don't think so.
Thanks, Gordon.